And I remember being drawn to this Jesus. I couldn't explain why. And I thought a lot of the things he was addressing were questions that I had had when I was in the yeshiva.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. This show is brought to you by Premier Christianity. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine, which I have the pleasure of editing. If you enjoy these interviews on The Profile, you are sure to love the magazine. So check out our subscription offers available today at premierchristianity.com. Here on The Profile, we like to talk to a different Christian leader each and every week and hear something of their life story, their faith background, and what God is doing through them. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on the show is Aaron Abramson. He is the Executive Director and CEO of Jews for Jesus. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be here.
We like to go back to the beginning here on the show and talk about a person's early life growing up. And there's lots to delve into here because you were born and raised, I think, in Seattle into an American Jewish family. So tell me more about what that was like and what your memories are of growing up.
Sure. Yeah, actually, my parents are both from the U.S. They were originally from Detroit, and I was actually born in Detroit, but didn't live there long. They moved to Seattle, where they wanted to raise us with some religious upbringing. And so my mom had grown up in a Catholic background, and my dad had grown up Jewish. So a lot of Jewish people might not realize this, but they're intermarried. And so I grew up in an intermarried family in that way. My mom did eventually convert to Judaism so that we could go to Jewish schools, because Judaism is really through the mother's lineage. That's how it's seen. So that gave us full legitimacy within the Jewish community. But I was raised with a little bit of everything, a little Christmas, a little Hanukkah, a little Easter, a little Passover, you know, some of those different customs and traditions. And my parents actually wanted us to have some, they were pretty secular, but they wanted us to have some religious upbringing at some point. And so they started sending us to the local synagogue and sending us to the local, like, little church nearby. And, you know, there was, like, different things like that. They were almost putting a toe in the water, so to speak, for some sort of religious experience and upbringing. And then they started to do more at home and get more interested in what God really had for them as a family. And so they found this messianic congregation in the Seattle area. So they started attending that, and they wanted me to have a bar mitzvah. And so for those who might not know what that is, when you're 13, you take on the rites of manhood, and you basically read from the Torah, the books of Moses in Hebrew, and you read from the Haftorah, which are the prophetic writings. And so I did that through this messianic congregation because they wanted to sort of meld or blend the traditions of their own upbringing. So that was quite interesting. That was sort of an introduction in a lot of ways, sort of to begin to process what it is that I think and believe personally. Mm. But I couldn't really call myself a believer at that point in my life. It would be sort of later on when I was about 23 that I would eventually come to faith. So a lot happened between 13 and 23.
Sure. And I think one of the things that happened during 13 and 23 was you actually relocated to Israel.
That's right.
So tell me what that's like. Because you're a teenager. You're born in Detroit, raised in Seattle. That's presumably a bit of a culture shock going from America to the Middle East.
Complete culture shock, especially Seattle. I remember Israel was so bright, just sunlight. I was not used to the direct sunlight. I mean,
yes, us Brits who go to Israel have a similar experience. Yeah. We're used to cold and dreary and gray skies, and then you're like, what is this thing called the sun?
Yeah,
and
you're not used to it. And so I remember that adjustment was pretty amazing. But yeah, my parents moved to Israel. So imagine, you know, you're going from one culture, which really there's not a lot of Jewish tradition in Seattle. There are some pockets of Orthodox Jewish community and, you know, conservative Jewish community and things like that. And you've got different Jewish people who live there. But imagine going to a country where suddenly the national holidays are the Jewish holidays. So Passover is a national holiday. You know, these different occasions, you get work off and school off and all that kind of stuff. So they moved there. I was 15. And I'm beginning to process what life looks like as a Jew in a very unique and fresh way. And so I begin to explore my Jewish background in more depth. And my parents wanted me to have more Jewish education. So I ended up going to a yeshiva, which is where you might go to become a rabbi, and studied Orthodox Judaism full time. Literally, you wake up at 6:30 in the morning for shacharit, which are the morning prayers, all the way through the day till about 10 at night. You're studying the Torah, you're studying the Talmud, you're studying all these rabbinic writings and exploring what those writings mean and how to apply them to your life. And so you're keeping all the commandments and the kosher laws and all the different things. And at that point, I remember asking, why does God want us to do all this? Like, what is this all about? You know, it just seemed extremely tedious, all the different rules, and not really understanding exactly why. And I would ask the rabbis, it wasn't exactly the type of place where you would ask that kind of a question. It was kind of like, just do the stuff you're asked to do.
Do what you're told.
Yeah, keep the Torah, do that kind of thing. So I found myself kind of running away a little bit in the afternoons when I had time off. And, you know, I'd try to, you know, walk around and get out of the yeshiva and things like that. But in many respects, being there for a year, I left after that year not really more solidified in my faith. And, you know, maybe I had better understanding of what it meant to be Jewish and that, but I didn't find myself being drawn to God or the God of Israel. And I was drafted into the IDF at 18.
That's the Israeli Defense Force.
That's right. And
so this is, we should explain, this is quite, I think, quite normal for Israeli young people.
It's compulsory. Everybody, male and female, would serve for, at that time, it was 3 years compulsory service for men. And I was enlisted like every other teenager my age.
Yeah.
And so imagine going from high school, and I'd been in the yeshiva at that time, to going directly into the military. And I was the first of five kids at the time in Israel. So imagine that was completely new for our family, going into that experience. And I served in some pretty volatile places. I served in southern Lebanon. I served in the West Bank and places like that.
What period of time is this?
So this was from 92 to 95.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Israel, for those who know their kind of recent history, will be able to place that in terms of...
Correct.
Wider conflict.
There were things going on. Israel was occupying southern Lebanon, you know, because of all of the different groups that were coming through the north. So it was a very, very volatile period with a lot of suicide bombings in Israel and all kinds of things happening. So while I was in the service in the first year, probably around 6 months, a close friend of mine from the yeshiva was kidnapped, and he eventually was found. He had been tortured and killed by Hamas terrorists in Israel. And that shook me. I didn't know what to do with that. Without really a lot of faith in anything, became somewhat disillusioned, maybe embittered on some levels, just didn't really think there was much of a future for me in Israel. So I decided after my time in the military, I would leave. And so I finished 3 years in the military and found myself really feeling like that was it for me.
Wow. So... It's interesting hearing you talk about young people serving, because those of us who visited Israel, we sometimes have this experience where just on street corners, you can see people who, to most of us, look very, very young because they are straight out of school, you know, holding machine guns in an army uniform. You were the first in your family to go through that. And then to have someone close to you to be killed in the midst of that conflict must have been incredibly difficult to deal with as a young person. I think we forget just how young some of these people are, how young you were. Tell me more about what happened next and how that was influential in your own faith journey.
Yeah. Well, like a lot of friends of mine that I got to know, I found myself just trying to find ways to cope. And so, you know, you go home occasionally when you're in, you know, Israel's a small country, so you can from time to time go home. That's why you'll see IDF soldiers, if you go to Israel, that are just going home or traveling, and they're on the weekends or other times, you know, they're not in the base. And I would find myself just disengaging, sleeping a lot, you know, going out, partying, all that kind of stuff, just like teenagers might do, just to get away from it all. And everybody talks about, when I'm done here, I'm going to go to India, or I'm going to go to South America, or I want to go to Australia. And I just thought America would be the answer for me, because my parents had been from there and I could go back. And I just thought, my memories of America, I just thought that'll solve everything. So I served my 3 years in the military, and then I got a job just to save up enough money to go back to America.
Yeah.
And,
At that point, you had a sort of dual Christian Jewish sort of heritage from your parents, but it sounds like up to this point in the story, it was mainly Jewish, because they'd moved to Israel. You'd gone to an Orthodox school.
Yeah.
So I guess at that point in your life, you would have identified certainly culturally as Jewish, but potentially religiously as well.
At that point,
sure.
I would have even said I was atheist.
Okay.
By that point.
Sure.
I wouldn't have even said I believed in God.
Wow.
The spiritual realm seemed just so far off to me by this point in my life. So reading these books felt more like just entertaining on some level. While I was searching for truth, I think I was just open to different ideas and just wanted to explore and see what's out there.
Yeah. So what happened next?
Yeah, so I remember specifically encountering Christians along the way. These moments stood out to me. I remember one moment, I was in San Diego, and I was playing guitar for a few bucks on the street and singing, and this one guy was standing there for a while. And after I was done with the song, it was getting dark. I remember thinking, okay, this guy, I don't know, he's just standing here. He's not really engaging with me. He's not giving me any money, because, you know, here I am trying to make my living as well. When I was on the road, I didn't have work often. So this was one of the ways that I'd get, you know, a few dollars for something to eat. And he said, hey, I live nearby here. Are you hungry? I said, okay, that's interesting. And it turns out he invited me to just hang out at his house, take a shower if I needed. He lived nearby. And when he heard that I was from Israel, he was extremely interested and told me he was a Christian and that he was studying the Bible and he had this heart for Jewish people and for Israel. And that really was like weird to me.
It was brand new for you.
It was like, why?
Yeah.
And I remember the other thing that stood out was that he was blind. He had like these dark glasses on, and I kind of had to lead him back to his house. But I remember thinking to myself, wow, this guy's quite trusting. Like, he doesn't know me, he's never met me, yet he's letting me into his home. You know, how does he know who I am and that I wouldn't take advantage of the situation? But that left an impression on me. He didn't really push and start quoting scripture at me or doing any of those things. He just really showed me, he did tell me he was a believer in Jesus. He did tell me he had a heart for Jewish people and for Israel. And I don't remember a whole lot of other quote-unquote witnessing or evangelism. After that, I went to San Francisco, and in San Francisco, I met these people on the street who invited me to a home where it was this house that they would make stews and food and invite people that were travelers and other things, and they were overtly Christian. I just remember that as well. And a couple of them shared the gospel with me here and there, and I remember just saying, yeah, thanks, I'm not very interested. And from there, I went up to Seattle, and my family had been living in Seattle prior, so we knew some people. And one of the people that we knew invited me around, and he was a believer in Jesus. And while we were over, challenged me to read the New Testament at some point and said, Aaron, I think that you're looking for answers, and I think you're going to find those answers here. And he also said this other thing that really got under my skin. He said, I think that it's a matter of life and death. And that was like, wait, what do you mean it's a matter of life and death, you know? And so I just began to read the New Testament after that. I didn't know why. I just thought, well, I haven't really explored it in depth here. I've been reading all these other books, from Buddhism to Hare Krishnas to, you know, New Age. Maybe I ought to give the New Testament a shot.
Wow. So in reading the New Testament, was that how you encountered the person of Jesus, and was that the kind of moment for you of coming all the way through to faith?
It certainly was. The New Testament, I didn't have a lot of people talking to me at this point. I just started to read through the Gospels. You know, often when you start with a book, where do you go? You start at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I was reading through the book of Matthew, and I remember being drawn to this Jesus. I couldn't explain why. Mm. There was no logical reason for me. It wasn't like I hadn't heard of who he was, but there was something in his teaching. And I thought a lot of the things he was addressing were questions that I had when I was in the yeshiva. Mm. And Jesus was addressing, like, well, you know, what are all these commandments? What do they point to? And he's asked, what's the purpose of the law, the writings, the prophets, and what are the most important commandments? And one point he says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, mm. which is a very Jewish idea, right? Mm. The Shema is, you know, hear, O Israel, you know, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And it goes on from there. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. You know, but then it says this other thing, and I hadn't thought about it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says those are the two commandments where everything in the law pivots. And I remember thinking about that. I mean, God wants a relationship with me, but God also wants me to relate to others in a way that is edifying and changes in a lot of ways everything. If we all related in this way that Jesus related, what would the world look like? Mm. And I found myself being drawn to Jesus, almost rooting for him through the Gospels. And when I get to the end of Matthew, of course, I knew the story enough to know that he, you know, he's crucified and that he's raised again from the dead according to these books. But then I get to the very end, I think, well, that's great. If I was to become a follower of him, I mean, I am really rough around the edges. I don't see myself fitting into any church. How would this even work? Mm-hmm. You know, what am I supposed to do about this now? And I get to the last verse of the book of Matthew, and it says, I am with you always to the very end of the age. And that's when, of course, he's ascending. But I remember thinking about this and going, you mean Jesus is with me? Like, it's not just this historical thing, but it's a present thing, and he's going to help me figure this out. And it just gave me all the confidence in the world. So I said, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. I don't know what this is going to look like. It's kind of messy, but I'm going to see what happens. And that was really the beginning of a profound change in my life.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you reached that question of, I'm not sure if I'll fit into church. And it makes me wonder how many other people feel that way, that for whatever reason, church can actually be a bit off-putting. And I think especially for some people, if people in churches look all just a little bit like they've all got it together and it's all smiles. And I mean, your situation is you're traveling. It sounds like you're borderline homeless. You're playing music on the streets to get a few dollars to... You know, you can imagine how someone in that situation may look at church and think, maybe this isn't for me. So,
I mean, literally, without getting into too much depth, I mean, I was doing drugs while I'm reading the Bible.
Right.
And I'm going, this is amazing. Look at what I'm reading here. And at one point, you know, after I become a believer in Jesus, I had nobody telling me, maybe you don't want to do that. You know, it's probably not something that's healthy for you. I just realized it on my own. Yeah. It was like, maybe I don't need this anymore. Maybe I can let go of that.
Yeah.
And these things just started falling away by themselves. And then I started to seek out a church because it was like, okay, I probably need to meet with other Christians now.
Yeah. So what was that experience like going to church the first time?
Well, so all of this journey is happening. I'm in the States about a year. Okay. And at the end of the year, I know I have a return ticket. Okay. Now, initially I thought I'm going to blow this ticket off, but now I'm starting to explore my faith in a deeper way. And it wasn't like, you know, November 20th, you know, 1997 or 6, I made this decision. It was more like over a period of a couple of months.
Sure. Yeah.
So it was at the end of that time that I returned to Israel because I thought, well, maybe I have this return ticket. I should go home. And I go back to Jerusalem where my parents lived, and I'm there. I'm like, basically on a couch or, you know, just sleeping in a temporary situation. And I'm pouring through the New Testament at this time. And as I'm doing that, I think to myself, well, and I hear actually through my mom about this church in the old city. And it's this church run by this guy named Issam Hussein. okay, which doesn't sound Jewish to me. Turns out he's from an Arab background and has started this church, and it's been, you know, growing, and it's a lot of former Muslim believers in this church. And I think to myself, well, if the gospel truly does, like, bring harmony between us and God and us with one another, I need to explore and I need to find out more about this. So I go to this church and I'm literally, you know, the old city, you've got all these little alleyways.
Narrow, yeah. winding streets.
It's like a maze or a labyrinth.
It is like a maze, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going through this labyrinth, right? And I'm going to the Armenian Quarter, if I remember correctly. I couldn't even remember where it is now if I was to try and retrace my steps. But eventually I get to this spot and it's like, okay, this is where the church is. Okay, am I sure? You know, it's all, I'm Israeli Jewish. There's all these, you know, Arab Muslims, I'm thinking, or maybe Orthodox Christians or others, but I don't fit in clearly. And the pastor sees me and I come down. And it's like this doorway going down. And I remember he looks at me. I look at him. I look at this room. I'm thinking, I don't know if I should walk down here. Maybe I shouldn't. And there's all these eyes looking up at me. And he says, welcomes, you know, introduces himself. I tell him who I am, and he welcomes me in with a hug. And over this next period, I remember him just being the sweetest person. He had this heart for me. They reached out to me. They were like brothers and sisters. And I thought to myself, okay, this is the true power of the gospel, because all of my bitterness and my maybe not even bitterness, maybe not even resentment, maybe just suspicion. A lot of that just kind of fell away, and my trust was in God, and suddenly I had these new brothers and sisters.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
So this brings me to a really interesting question of, what do I call you? Now, obviously, your name is Aaron, but do I call you a Christian? Do I call you a Messianic Jew? Do I call you, I've heard the term completed Jew before. And for those who wonder why I'm even asking this question, maybe you can explain some of the background to this whole conversation or debate. You know, why for some people, perhaps even yourself, it's not necessarily an obvious or a helpful term to even call you a Christian. Why would some who are Jewish followers of Jesus perhaps not want to use that term? And what term do you use?
Yeah, so I'm okay with pretty much whatever. I mean, I see you got Christianity up here, Premier Christianity. I don't have a problem with being called a Christian. I mean, Christ is, you know, of course, comes from Christos and the Greek idea of the Messiah, which is a Jewish idea to begin with, the anointed one. And we're followers of that anointed one, that Messiah that God, you know, worked through. So I don't have that big of a problem with it, but I realize that Christianity is a loaded term. It's got a lot of history, and unfortunately for the Jewish people, a lot of that history has been quite bloody, and honestly, a lot of the people who perpetrated some of the most shocking persecution of Jewish people called themselves Christians and often would do these things, calling the Jews things like Christ killer and things like that. No, you did this to Jesus, so we're going to do this to you. And it's a sad thing to hear that, because I also know that there are many people who love Jesus throughout history who also loved people and love Jewish people and even protected Jewish people during some of those horrific times. But my family had left Eastern Europe to get away from that and came to the U.S. Back at, you know, kind of the turn of the century, like 1900s, early 1900s. So I think because of that, the idea that I would go home to my relatives and say, guess what I am now? I'm a Christian. That word has often felt like you've defected to the other team. Mm-hmm. You know, you've left your Jewishness. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of Jewish people, they prefer to be called Messianic Jews because they still want to be identified as, hey, I'm Jewish. Mm. I was born Jewish. I still see my faith firmly rooted within Jewish tradition. In fact, I believe I've discovered the Jewish Messiah, which is a Jewish thing. So I don't see those two things as, you know, contradictory. I see them as complementary, mm-hmm. and they work together. And ultimately, they see their New Testament faith as a fulfillment of their Jewishness and their calling. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people would actually say, if you talk to Messianic Jews or Jews that follow Jesus or Jewish followers of Jesus or whatever they might call themselves, you might talk to one of them and they might say, after I became a believer in Jesus, my Jewishness became so much more important to me. And I would say that was my experience. You know, here I'd run away from Israel, trying to almost shed that in a lot of ways from my background. And God, of course, had his hand on me. And eventually when I did start begin reading through the Bible, that Jewish thread in my own life and those experiences and that custom suddenly became a lot clearer. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I mean, God could work through that. And not only did God work through that, but we see that the first followers of Jesus were Jews. Mm. And they had believed that they had discovered the Jewish Messiah. So suddenly all these things like Passover and Jewish customs took on new meaning.
And is there a benefit for people like me who aren't Jewish to understand Judaism today or Jewish traditions or things like Passover? Is there a benefit to me in understanding those things because it might enhance my own Christian faith?
Absolutely. I would say that's an absolute, absolutely positive experience. And there's a couple of reasons I'd say why. One is the context simply of the Bible. It's impossible to really grasp some of the different nuances and the different things that Jesus is speaking about or Paul's speaking about or, you know, let alone the Old Testament, without really diving into that. And understanding sort of the cultural milieu and the different circumstances that these writers were in, that's one thing. The other thing is that Jesus himself was born a Jew. There's no way to get around that. It's just a fact. And God chose for him to be born at a certain time in history to a certain family. And so Jesus' teachings are thoroughly Jewish. And so rather than sort of say, well, Jesus, you know, I've had people say Jesus was a good Jew until he converted to Catholicism, or, you know, they make statements because they don't realize that Jesus, his teaching is thoroughly Jewish. It comes out of the Jewish world. It comes out of the Jewish scriptures. It comes out of Jewish history. And so if we want to understand Jesus and we want to draw closer to him, in a sense, we can't just divorce his Jewishness completely from that.
So there's a good reason why Gentile Christians might want to understand Jesus' Jewish background, but you're not suggesting those same Gentile Christians would need to convert to Judaism or, I don't know, start observing the Sabbath in a Jewish way or...
Well, and that's a great question. I think that question is wrestled through in the book of Acts, right? Because once we start seeing Gentiles responding to the gospel, and you see that it's happening with Peter and it's happening with Paul, and you're starting to see these outlying communities being reached, they, of course, hold this council in Jerusalem to explore, okay, how do we deal with this issue? And there probably were people saying, well, they need to become Jews. And I think they come to the conclusion very clearly there that they don't need to become Jews. They're born non-Jewish, and that's part of God's plan. There were the ethnos or the goyim, which is in Hebrew another way to say nations of the world, and there were the Jewish people that God ultimately started this covenant with, but he extends that, and we start to see that extending through the Messiah and through the new covenant to these non-Jewish communities. Hmm. And the wonderful thing is they didn't have to start observing everything. That being said, there were some basic things that, of course, they were instructed to do.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And like you say, one we're probably still wrestling with in different ways.
Absolutely. And I would say, however, for the sake of the beauty of the story of the gospel and, you know, the Last Supper was a Passover Seder, you know? So for us as Christians, if we want to understand that experience to understand it in its original context, I think there's benefit to that.
We publish a whole range of Christian views on our website, premierchristianity.com. And a couple of years ago now, we published a piece by a Messianic Jew explaining why it's a good thing for Christians to celebrate Passover. And they were explaining from a Christian point of view, Jesus is the fulfillment of the Passover lamb and all this imagery. And we publish a range of opinions. I'm not saying that's the only Christian view, because it's not. But by and large, our Christian audience liked it. Jewish people found this article, and it caused huge amounts of controversy online, with quite literally hundreds of people really strongly objecting, saying this is incredibly offensive.
Right.
You're stealing our festival. You're appropriating our festival. This is a Jewish Passover Seder. Yeah. It's completely inappropriate for Christians to
I've heard that.
So for yourself, as someone who is Jewish, who is also a follower of Jesus, where do you stand on that issue?
I mean, they're making a point, I think, that is an interesting one. And I mean, it's one that I think it's worth pausing and reflecting on. I would err on the side, however, of those experiences being significant and meaningful as they're understood to be Jewish and understood to be part of the Jewish experience today. I think if they're kind of taken out of that and said, well, now this is our thing and you're not, you know, really part of that, I think that's a different kind of situation. I can understand how they feel like, hey, hang on a minute, this is our tradition. But I don't think, again, that these are mutually exclusive traditions. I mean, you can't state that Christianity doesn't come out of this very Jewish book with Jewish experiences that talk about all these different things, and that Jesus himself doesn't talk about those things. He absolutely did. So I think it would be a bit unnatural. And in fact, I think we're used to a Christianity that's been a bit sanitized from some of that. We've almost taken, it's almost like we've taken those passages and sort of minimized them or divorced them from our faith. Mm. And in some ways, I think that's to the detriment of Christianity. Mm. So to me, it's not correct that these aren't Christian experiences and that we can't, as Christians, partake in them and benefit from them. I think that we absolutely can.
Yeah. I want to come back to your story a little bit. So what are your memories of telling family and friends about encountering Jesus through the scriptures, particularly Jewish friends and family? What were their reaction to what happened to you?
It ranged, of course. I had some friends that thought I was absolutely crazy. What did you do? Some too much drugs, or what happened to you? You know, how did you end up in this cult? Or, you know, they would feel that I had made a poor decision based on where I was at in life. My own family had more or less positive reactions to it. They were okay with it.
Were your parents already Messianic Jews at this
point? So my parents became believers over the years, and were open
to it. So it wasn't contentious for your parents?
Not really, no. Yeah. Now, we weren't, I hadn't really been part of a church or anything like that, and so I didn't really have that experience until I became a believer in Jesus. At that point, it wasn't like in Israel we had been part of something like that. So I think it almost revived my family in some ways when I became this follower of Jesus and was so excited about the scripture and teaching. You know, suddenly my siblings and others became interested. Yeah. So it had this effect, I think, on the rest of my family.
Yeah, and did that lead into a bit of a discovery for you of perhaps a gift for evangelism, a particular desire to share your faith? Because obviously we're going to talk about what you've done since then, and a lot of that is missionary, evangelistic kind of work. So were you maybe discovering that at an early stage, that you were finding real joy in sharing this good news?
Yeah, well, my life had been so turned upside down, and I had found so much hope and just newfound life. I just found like it was like going from Seattle to Israel in terms of that light analogy. I just felt like, wow, you know, there's so much light here that I wanted my friends and I wanted other Israelis and other Jewish people to hear it. So I started to try to figure out how to get that word out. And again, I started with my closest friends. Two of my closest friends, incidentally, they initially were kind of pushing back. And one of them actually said, even if Jesus is the Messiah, I would never follow him. And I remember thinking, why? Like, you just said, if he was the Messiah, like the Jewish Messiah, why, you know? And I think even he realized that was a little absurd, because some weeks later, he ended up coming to church with me and eventually also became a believer. And my other close friend became a believer as well. So two of my closest friends became believers at that time, through partially through my experience, but other things were going on in their lives. And I remember the three of us started to like do Bible studies and try to share our faith in Jerusalem. And it was not easy. I had roadblock after roadblock. I just felt like it wasn't getting through to people. People thought that was crazy. I'd share with different ones. Back in those days, it was pretty volatile to be open like that and try to share. You could have people get violent on you. People
so
get
this
upset.
This is other Jews.
Other Jews, yeah.
Offended, really.
Yeah.
That you, as a Jew, was talking about Jesus.
Yeah, why are you trying to, you know,
I think it's important to set that in context, isn't it? That, correct if I'm wrong, my understanding is that when Israel became a nation in modern times in 1948, certainly then the idea of a messianic Jew in Israel was almost unheard of.
Well, yeah, and they would say, you've taken on another monotheistic religion.
Right.
So you're no longer...
You've converted away from Judaism and become
so some of them would say you're no longer Jewish. Now, most people disagree with that. Even Orthodox Jews would say, no, you're just not an observant Jew, or you're not a Jew that's doing what you're supposed to do. So for those of us who... A very small community in Israel who had said, I am a follower of Jesus and I identify publicly that way. It felt like aliens from outer space had landed next door. You know what I mean? Like Jewish people didn't know why you would believe that.
And how much is that changing? Because my understanding is since then, you know, actually this is a bit of an era of growth.
It is. I would say back in those days, it was a pretty unusual thing. Mm. And I mean, it's not, it's still very small.
It's still small, the community. But it's less unusual than it
was. It's true. It's also more publicly seen. I think it used to be very under the radar. It was seen as a non-Israeli, non-Jewish thing. Mm. There'd be these American Christians that come and do tours and things like that. Or there were Orthodox, like Coptic Christians and Catholic and other people. But Israeli Jews, you know? And so over time, Israeli Jews in all sorts of different spheres of life who were followers of Jesus became more public and more well-known and more out in the open about their faith.
So you were on the streets doing some of this evangelism, and it was hard, hard work.
Very, like, daunting. And, you know, I'm literally thinking, man, I'm going to get found out here, and, you know, I'm going to get chased out of here. And, you know, there were stories of people got attacked and things like that. Because it's seen as... also, like, you're stealing Jews away from their Jewishness. And so we would say, no, we actually want them to stay Jewish. We think it's great that they're Jewish. We just believe that there's this fulfillment in accepting our Messiah, that as Jews, it's even more important because it comes out of our heritage, and we're missing this key piece of our own faith. So I'm trying to get out there and do this, and, you know, I meet these other people through Jews for Jesus that are out there too. It wasn't very common. A lot of the people at that time were not openly doing evangelism. And so Jews for Jesus did that. And I appreciated that about them. And I also needed training. So Jews for Jesus invited me to go to the U.S. to do a summer, both training in Jewish evangelism and also to do this campaign, which was on the streets of New York City for a month.
Wow. And how much did Jews for Jesus... sort of tactics or strategy changed over time?
Tons, in a lot of different ways. Jews for Jesus historically started in the U.S., and I know we're getting into maybe a slightly different conversation here about Jews for Jesus, but Jews for Jesus started in the United States in the 1970s, and it was an activism movement. I mean, think about it. These are Jews who one day they're protesting the Vietnam War, and the next day they're these brand new believers in Jesus who are being told, you can't be Jewish and believe that. And so they're like, well, yeah, we can. And we're going to be open about it. And we're going to be public about it. And so they took that to the streets. Mm-hmm. And New York was one of the most densely populated Jewish communities, especially, you know, outside of Israel. It was the largest. And so we would go there and we'd do these extensive campaigns. And we'd be on the streets with T-shirts, handing out literature and getting into conversations with people. But it was very, like, face-to-face, very direct, you know, and quite intense, actually.
I was going to say, you say face-to-face, I was going to say it was very in your face. I
mean, it was, yeah.
You know, arguably, you know, Jews for Jesus actually had quite a lot of criticism sometimes for its tactics of just mm-hmm. being very forthright. So I say, you know, has that approach changed? I don't know, but
yeah. Well, and I'd say our approach is we're still direct about who we are. I mean, most people figure it out right when they hear our name, you know, what we're about. But our approach and our methodology has shifted, and I think over the years, we were doing very similar outreach from the 1970s into the 80s, and we were getting loads of contacts. You know, we'd go out on the streets, Jewish people would walk up to us, it was in some ways eliciting a reaction. Mm. You'd get positive and you'd get negative reactions, you know, and you had to get used to that. You'd have people screaming at you, people throwing stuff, and then people responding. But in the 2000s, something started to shift. And with the rise of digital and, you know, iPhones, and people were plugged in, walking around, and they were there was so much competing for their attention. You know, and here we are in the streets of New York, and I moved back. I'd lived in New York when I started with Jews for Jesus, and again, I can go back and share a little bit about my story with Jews for Jesus, but I started Jews for Jesus in 2000. It was 1999, actually, here in London. I did an internship in London here. And then I went to New York City and I started with our ministry full time. Now, I'd done a volunteer campaign in the 90s, like I explained in 98, on the streets of New York. And we used to have lots of contacts. We had a database full of Jewish leads, people that were saying, hey, I'm open, call me, you know, I want to talk more. And we'd see people come to faith on a regular basis through that. Some of them were Russian-speaking Jews. Some of them were Hebrew-speaking Jews. Some of them, not as many Orthodox, but you'd have occasionally some. And in the early 2000s, that became more difficult. And so in a lot of ways, we started to ask the question, is our approach effectively reaching the Jewish community, right? And I think what had happened over the years was people started to kind of almost understand our strategy. And they saw it almost like, imagine a sports analogy. Like, they saw what we were going to do, and so their defenses were up, right? And they would oppose that. And so there were different groups within the Jewish community that were educating, you know, don't talk to these people who go out, and you'll see them in T-shirts, and they're doing this, handing out literature. And so we had, in many respects, lost our ability to have conversations with the community. And so that was a hard realization to kind of go through. And then to say, well, what are we going to do to reach these people if we're not going to do this? But I also found some tools in the vein of human-centered design, like design thinking, and some of the things like user experience and things that companies and organizations, even the city of New York, was utilizing some of these tools to be able to say, how do we meet the needs of our constituents, of our community? And some of those tools, I started to take them and play with them a little bit, along with prayer and a lot of, you know, but a lot of ways it's trial and error. Mm. It's prototyping things and being really honest about the results. Mm-hmm. And through that process, we deconstructed our mission approach in New York City and began some new styles of ministry.
So what was the new ministry?
Well, so a lot of it was things we weren't going to do anymore. Okay, that might sound hard, but sometimes you need to let go of certain things. And one of the things was sort of the going out with the matching T-shirts and the literature and all the subways in New York was reinforcing some of the beliefs that we were part of a cult. Mm-hmm. And it was also keeping people at an arm's distance, an arm's length. So what we realized was we want to create proximity so that these Jewish people who maybe have never met anybody that's Jewish that believes in Jesus could sit down and have a conversation and interact with us. And so one of the things we did was really began to lean into events and Jewish things like Shabbat dinners. That experience of sitting down and having a Shabbat dinner with Jews who believed in Jesus broke down walls where a Jewish person could suddenly say, okay, hang on a minute. You're actually very Jewish, number one. You've got a Jewish story. But number two, you're not a cult member. You're not a crazy. You're somebody who's thought through your faith. And I'm finding you really engaging to talk to. Mm. And a lot of that broke down some of that sort of distance that we had experienced.
There's been this sad and very long history of Christian anti-Semitism, in the sense that quite prominent Christians down through history have expressed some horrific attitudes. I mean, a number of Christians aren't even aware of people like Martin Luther, who's heralded as the great reformer, but not many people know that he wrote a book called On the Jews and Their Lies, and you know, endorsed the burning of synagogues and other horrific things. And I think a lot of Christians aren't aware of that, but a lot of Jews are. And there's been this history of Christian anti-Semitism, which, as you say, has been off-putting. I want to ask you about the present day, though. Is there a problem of anti-Semitism today among Christians? And if there is, that is no doubt hampering what you're trying to do in win Jewish people to Jesus. If there's still perception, fairly or unfairly, is there still a perception that actually Christians are against us, and anti-Semitism in Christian parts of the West, let's say, seems to be rising?
That's a very necessary issue to address, and I'm so glad, Sam, that you brought it up, because I think we have an opportunity right now in what's going on, because so much of the world has seen Jewish people almost as a pariah people, or people that because of Israel and some of the things that are going on, it's just, they're just almost seen as a group that you can hate. And we've seen the evidence of that, because anti-Semitic acts have gone up ridiculously. I mean, if you look at the stats, I saw stats in New York, I've seen stats in London, it's terrible to see what's happened. And I mean, I'm talking about all sorts of things. I mean, I know people have been beaten up just because they had a Jewish symbol on or something like that. So it's not like it's not happening. It's definitely happening, and it's happening at a rate that's alarming. Christians, I think, have a unique opportunity. Sadly, I will say there are some Christians who, when this issue has come up, have, I would say, I don't see a ton of overt anti-Semitism. There, it does exist. There's an increasing group, especially like podcasters and others, who have become more vocal about almost like Israel's at the root of all evil, and they like control this.
Conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
You know, anti-Semitic Jewish theories.
Oh, yeah. And some of it's just crazy stuff. And you see it in the United States, like, oh, the Israelis were behind 9/11, and the Israelis are behind this, and the Israelis orchestrate and puppet everything. Even though we're, you know, we're a people that maybe is 15 million around the world. 15 million people. I mean, come on, let's put it in perspective. You know, there's, you know, hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East that are not Jews. You know what I mean? So you have to kind of see it in perspective. But I would say, maybe while you don't see as much overt anti-Semitism, that anti-Semitic, I'd almost call it, you could call it in some ways like a supersessionism that kind of has crept in to the church over the years, where it could just be, oh, we don't talk about those things, or we have a certain coldness toward those things, unfortunately comes up, and Jewish people feel it. They really do feel it. And so it stands out all the more when a church says, hey, we're praying for you. That's all they're saying. Hey, we care about you. We see you. You exist. Right now, that is a powerful message. Hmm. And the church has an opportunity to share that message with Jewish people. Forget politics for a second. You know, you might not even agree with everything. Just by saying we love Jewish people and we have a heart for you and we're praying for you doesn't mean you're saying I'm endorsing every single thing that this Israeli prime minister or the party in Israel is doing. You may disagree with some of that. Hmm. But I think there's an opportunity for that. And unfortunately, a lot of Jews haven't been hearing this from Christians. I will also say, though, that there is an improved perception of Christianity from, I'd say, from my grandmother's era.
Right.
You know, where it used to just be overt. Mm. You know, you're a Jew, you killed Jesus, this is your fault. My grandmother would have felt a little bit suspicious if a Christian was, you know. So I think that today there's an opportunity, though, for Christians to just come alongside and say, hey, you're my Jewish neighbor. How you doing?
So tell me about Jews for Jesus in the UK. You're working right here in London.
Yeah, so we've got a team that's on the ground here, and they're reaching out in the Jewish community, primarily, like you said, in London, though there are other Jewish pockets in other places. And we've got Hebrew speakers on the team. We've got local British cultural Jews that are from London who reach out and lead Jews to faith. And so if there are people that are listening that have a Jewish friend, maybe somebody that's asked some questions or wants to explore the faith from a Jewish perspective a little bit more, feel free to reach out to Jews for Jesus. Actually, our website's just jewsforjesus.org, but you can go to our UK site as well, which is, I think, .org.uk. Is that it? How it normally goes?
Yep.
Yeah, jewsforjesus.org.uk, and you can reach out there and find our team. We also do things like Passover presentations for churches and other things to help people, like you were asking before, to explore some of the Jewish context and background of things, or even just how do I reach Jewish people with the gospel? What are some resources? So we've got a lot of resources on that. And then there's a YouTube channel called So Be It, which I mentioned briefly when we were in chat before, but they do some cool stuff on the streets, just interacting with Jewish seekers and conversations that maybe you haven't heard a conversation like those recently, and they're really fun to listen in on. So those are a few of the ways that Great. You can connect with Jews for Jesus if that's something that you feel is on your Great. Heart.
Now, I didn't want to let you go without mentioning your new book. It's out now, and it's called Mission Design, published by IVP. So tell me a bit about this book. What made you want to write it and what you're grappling with?
Yeah, so Mission Design was birthed out of that process that Jews for Jesus went through when we were, in a sense, deconstructing our mission approach. Mm. And I started to really try to process some of the things that I had gained and tools that I had learned about over those years, and to provide some sort of a guidebook for people, maybe in ministry, maybe you're a pastor, maybe you're a lay leader and you're leading a Bible study, or maybe, you know, you want to start something. How do you ask the right questions around really saying, what's the mission? How do we sort of get laser focused on what it is that we're trying to do? But then how do we understand if we're moving the needle? Mm. Because I think sometimes in ministry, we're dealing with those intangible goals, right? It's like, how do we know that we've impacted more people this year than last year? And I'm sure Premier Radio and Christianity is asking some of those questions, right? How do you know if you're moving the needle? And so really kind of defining what you're trying to do, and then designing using some of the tools that exist out, like the human-centered design tools that are out there, to begin to ask some of those questions and design your ministry along with prayer. And so the book takes you through Jews for Jesus' experience, some of what we did, some of what didn't work, draws in other ministry examples along with other business practices and things like that to say, here's a helpful handle for you if you're navigating change.
Mm, great. Well, it's out now, Mission Design, available wherever good Christian books are sold, I'm sure. But Aaron Abramson, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure to talk.
It's been good to be here. Thanks, Sam. Yeah.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.